Okay, time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy, Residence 104.4
FM in bleep. We can't say the name of the city we're in, of course.
Oh, yeah, it's under heavy, heavy copyright guard by the copyright police for the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. So on my Twitter stream last night, all these British people with tears in their eyes, and Piers Morgan was whinging on about why they should go back to building an empire. What exactly was his problem?
Yes, I have to read this because you won't believe it, really. So here's a guy who's now over at CNN, a network, a broadcaster who was really a innovator and revolutionary in its time when it started under Ted Turner, and now it's like got barely any traffic, nobody watches it, and this is the sort of person they hire. Here's his tweet. We need to be an empire again. Seriously. Hashtag proud of Britain.
Yeah, what's going on with Pierce? I mean, well, first of all, CNN's ratings are crashing. They just got rid of the president. They're looking for somebody new to run it. And cable TV, you know, in the U.S., CNBC, ratings are horrible. MSNBC, the ratings are down because cable. These news programs that are thinly veiled outlets for the Pentagon. I mean, you know, the Pentagon has carte blanche. Even on Comedy Central, you see Viacom, which is the parent company's, kowtowing to the Pentagon with at least once a week, Jon Stewart has some hero on who's written a book about being a hero, about everything is heroic. So, I mean, people are just tuning out because there's alternative media available now from English-speaking outlets around the world.
Well, you also see with the brand police deployed here in London to protect the sponsors of the Olympics, you know, you're seeing a raw, you know, in the meat space, blatant sort of, you know, manipulation of what you're allowed to see and hear. So, you know, CNN is heavily branded by various corporations as well. So what are they allowed to and allowed not to say? And that's part of the problem that those networks like MSNBC and CNN are experiencing at the moment, is that we have a global financial collapse. We have a global economic collapse. And a lot of it is brought about by the very same monopolies and oligarchies that have destroyed the global economy, but they can't mention any of this because of their brand police situation. And I think a lot of the audience, especially, say, under 50 years old, sort of area 40, they really have tuned out the most from CNN, MSNBC, under 35. So they, you know, they can see, you know, they could go online, they're living online, and they see other people speaking the truth about what's happening, but CNN and MSNBC are just never going to be able to say that. So I don't know how they're going to fix their ratings problem.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's even worse in the UK, where you can't even mention the names of banks that are going bankrupt because of the libel laws that are there to protect the royalty. They're there to protect the monarchy and the aristocrats. And you saw it on the opening display of the Olympics, which was basically Versailles at the height of the French monarchy. And you've got a very close court of billionaires assembled to celebrate commercialization of something that used to be in the public domain, that used to be a celebration of amateurism, that used to have some relevance before it became just a vehicle to push branded, copyrighted nonsense down people's throat. And even so, you know, it's funny to watch or look at the Drudge Report today because, the squabbling going on with Mitt Romney, who's a Republican candidate, slamming Britain with insults, and then Britain wondering who the heck is this Mitt Romney character, and, you know, quite rightfully belittling him with questions about, you know, who is he? I mean, we never heard of this guy, and So then Drudge comes back and, you know, with headlines like the Queen was picking her nose during the ceremonies and, you know, all these partisan attacks. And but again, it's like the Court of Versailles, where it's like the Duke of Wellington was upset at the Archbishop of Canterbury, and there might be no pudding for him tonight at the banquet celebrating the infallibility of our King Market, the Market King. It's the Market King and the Versailles Court of the Market King, and the people outside are growing restless, but the media doesn't cover it, just like Marie Antoinette doesn't cover it.
Well, I tell you one thing that stood out over the last 2 or 3 days was, regarding this Mitt Romney case, was Boris Johnson. And, you know, Max Kaiser said a few years ago that Boris Johnson would be the next prime minister after David Cameron. And I thought, no way. After having lived in the UK for so long and seeing all his gaffes and how people got so upset. But then I realized, you know, that was 10, 12 years ago. And those people don't matter so much anymore. The easily shocked and offended and outraged and, oh, you said the truth. How dare you? You know, those are the people that watch CNN or used to watch CNN. But here's a guy who just, you know, stood up in front of 30,000 people in the Olympic Stadium and trashed Mitt Romney in a very, you know, amusing, articulate way that American politicians are just unable to speak. But I think that, more than anything, really got the goat of the right wing in America, because how dare, you know, this is the empire thing. How dare you stand up to the empire and the emperor? You're supposed to be our lapdog. And they were, I think, probably surprised at this. This is that.
To follow up on this lapdog concept, again, Drudge on the top of the page was saying that the Brits honored their British war dead, but not Israeli war dead. Mm-hmm. That this is a controversy. The Israeli war dead were not honored, but the British war dead were honored. This is on top of the, I don't know if you saw that video, but Carney, who's a spokesman for Obama, was asked in a news conference from one of the reporters, tell us, what is the capital of Israel? And this guy Carney, the spokesperson, refused to answer the question and just kind of smirked and smiled and said, oh, we've been down this road before. You know I can't answer that question. You know that's not something I can talk about. And so there was a follow-up. Well, no, what is the capital of Israel? And, you know, they refused to answer that question. And, you know, this is you know, it gets back to Drudge saying you didn't honor the Israeli war dead, only the British war dead. So, what's that all about?
Well, that's because the capital is Tel Aviv, but the Israelis now want to claim it's Jerusalem, which is occupied territory. That's the Palestinians, and it's supposed to be part of the, you know, the alleged eventual peace accords. You know, they're supposed to sort out what they're going to do.
That's like Sandy Weil, you know, deciding to acquire travelers insurance and breaking the Glass-Steagall law with the concept that, well, we're going to change the law within a year and it's going to be retroactively legal.
Yeah.
Or this is the same thing that if you're in up on Wall Street or if you're part of Israel, the current laws make, they're not something to pay any attention to because you're going to change the law in the future and then retroactively you see you didn't break the law.
That's right. And now Max Kaiser. So we mentioned the forbidden word, by the way, already on the show this morning several times. We said the O word, Olympics. And we said London, I think, a few times. Yeah. I hope Resonance is not sued or visited by the brand police wearing their brown shirts and their black boots coming in there, probably stomping on Robin's head right now as we speak.
Well, it's a spectacle. And the economic numbers that came out in Britain before the Olympic ceremony showed a 2.7% contraction in GDP. I think, yeah, it's negative GDP. I mean, the way they reported in Britain was 0.7%, but everyone else in the world reports that number as an annualized number. So to give it a normalized, it's almost a 3% contraction in GDP. There's been a contraction in something like 5 of the past 7 quarters. The economy is shrinking. That's despite the money spent on this Olympics. You know, post-Olympics, when the hangover sets in from this hosting of the Versailles gathering of the billionaires, you know, the economy is in horrible shape. The austerity measures, of course, are there to bail out the bankers. The bankers, the Barclays chief operating officer, gets an £8 million golden parachute after being caught rigging LIBOR rates. And you know, the people are restless. They're out. They're not happy. The march to Versailles is gathering speed.
So here's another pretty sickening story. Okay, you mentioned we of course always talk about the banking crime wave that's aided and abetted and facilitated and harbored here in London, in the city of London. Sorry, and from today's Guardian, 6 sentenced for insider trading, but Ersin Mustafa, the JP Morgan casino print manager allegedly at the heart of the conspiracy, is said by brother to have avoided prosecutors by fleeing to Cyprus. So one of the 6 individuals sentenced on Friday to a total of 16 years in prison for taking part in an insider trading ring, has said the J.P. Morgan Cazenove print room manager, allegedly at the heart of the conspiracy, avoided prosecutors by fleeing to northern Cyprus. This guy was a contractor for Xerox running the secure print room in J.P. Morgan. Notice that they only find the blue-collar workers within these firms, the guys in the print room. Like, they can't find any evidence of the senior bankers running these global elaborate fraud schemes. And then when they do, like you said, they either retroactively change the law or they just ignore it, because the Department of Justice, or here the Crown Prosecution Service, has to be the one to file the charges. So in the U.S., we saw those legendary testimony and interchange between Senator Carl Levin and Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. And it was, you know, at the end of the Senate investigations, they said in no uncertain terms that Goldman Sachs had committed fraud against their clients with these collateralized debt obligations that they knew to be beepy. And he gave this to the Department of Justice, and Eric Holder decided not to prosecute.
Right. And by the way, there is no such thing as a print room. That's made up.
Really?
Yeah. What are they talking about? It's from the 18th century? What do they say? It's a print... What?
Well, they're saying that he worked in the secure print room in J.P. Morgan, and his brother worked at the print room for market-sensitive documents over at UBS. So the two of these... So all of the fraud... You know, UBS and J.P. Morgan really are... two of the most central banks, including, you know, those are the two, some of the most corrupt banks in the whole global financial system.
What do you mean by print room? There's no such thing as a print room. There are prints that happen on the ticker tape, and there's securities printing companies that print, that produce the securities, and maybe, you know, like De La Rue is a British company. They create documents, they create currency, they actually make the British pound currency and secure, and they make the securities documents. But firms themselves don't have a print room. There's no such thing. They made that up.
Well, they do say that how the ring operated is they said that they took thousands of confidential documents uploaded from bank computers onto USB memory sticks, and then downloaded them into a password-protected web email account. Oh, look, that sounds so highfalutin. They transmitted this information, Max, by a password-protected web email account. Gee, does anybody out there not have a password-protected email account?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think, yeah. Well, as you point out, though, these are just low-level people that it's like those people that the FBI or CIA set up to claim that they are going to bomb something by finding some mentally disturbed people on the street and sticking a grenade in their pockets and telling them it's a candy bar, and then saying, "Oh my God, you're trying to blow everything up. We better make this a big case and take you down to the court." So here you have some poor schlub in a non-existent facility called a print room, which doesn't exist, that is guilty of some infraction that proves that somebody's doing something somewhere. And meanwhile, the multi-hundred trillion dollar LIBOR scandal, the $1.6 billion stolen by Jamie Dimon at MF Global, et cetera, et cetera. You can list 30 items in the last 6 months. They're still trying to figure out if, in fact, they're going to go ahead and do anything about that.
Max, we can move on to another big Ponzi scandal that, of course, this was one of the earliest warnings from Max Keiser, another one way pre-IPO, before even, like, there were only rumors of an IPO pending, but that is Farmville Zynga, the makers of Farmville.
Yes.
This is quite remarkable. So I guess they reported earnings that disappointed. The Zynga did. Remember, they went public in the last year. And we covered this on Keiser Report from New York, where a few weeks after going public, they came up with an innovative idea to for the insiders to avoid the lockup period and get rid of their shares on a secondary offering. So they bailed out. The insiders bailed out at $12 a share. It's now down to $3. So the price collapsed. The stock price collapsed by 40% overnight after their earnings disappointed. And it continues to fall by 10, 15%. Now, Zynga, of course, provides 15% of the earnings for Facebook. So they also came out with disappointing earnings. And their shares have been tumbling by double digits a day for the last 2 days.
Yeah, that's right. We called this one from the very start. You know, this is really, it's really interesting because back on the 1980s, when I was working on Wall Street for a firm at that time, Payne Weber and then Oppenheimer, you know, these are considered to be bona fide, you know, firms. They have a high rating as a corporate entity. At the same time, down on Wall Street, you have various bucket shops operating. For one notorious was D.H. Blair. Another one was called Rooney Pace. But you have dozens of these bucket shops, and they come and go, and the brokers leave, and then they assemble again at another firm. And they specialize in these pump-and-dump schemes and taking companies public. You know, during those days, you would find a company that would be taken public and they have the cure for AIDS. And it's just two guys in white lab coats, you know, sitting around a university, you know, coffee machine talking about the fact that they're going to get around doing some research someday on AIDS. But somehow that got into a public offering document. And then these guys at these chop shops would call people up and say, you got to own this stock and, you know, AIDS tech, bio AIDS tech. Mm. You know, it's like on the NASDAQ, the symbol is BATE or something, or AIDS. Yeah, the symbol's AIDS. It's on the over-the-counter market. It's bio AIDS tech. And we're doing this offering, and so it's a pump and dump scam because the insiders at the firm all put in a few bucks into this shell company that doesn't really exist. So they end up with, let's say, $10 million in stock that's owned by the brokers themselves mostly. So then they get on the phone and they get people to buy up that stock. So this price starts to go up and the company's now worth $50 million or $100 million. And on the way up, of course, the brokers themselves are selling the stock. They're the ones selling the stock to the people on the other end of the phone who are buying the stock at a valuation of $50. And occasionally, you know, they really milk this thing so that you get people to buy it when it's going up one or two or three times, and they make a big deal of the fact that it's going up because they're about to announce a cure for AIDS, and they build this whole elaborate story, and it's all being pumped. And then once the insiders are completely sold out, then the company reports earnings, which are non-existent, and the stock goes to zero. Within a couple of days or months, it's delisted and it's completely gone. But everyone lost 100% of their money. Now, in the case of Facebook, this is the whole thing. This pump and dump scam, you might have seen it with a $20 million company, a $50 million company. Here you've got a $104 billion company that is nothing more than a pump and dump scam, where Barack Obama himself putting his arm around Mark Zuckerberg in the White House, being used to entice suckers into the stock at $38 a share. Now it's at $23 a share, on its way to $9 a share. And and Zynga, of course, is even less of a company. It's a fad, basically. I mean, I feel bad because they've corrupted the virtual currency space, unfortunately. There's something to do there, but they're not the people to do it, but they've destroyed it. And so you end up with this. Anyway, we knew it a year ago. It was obvious a year ago that this is what was going on. Groupon, the same thing. And but it's not. You know, the financial press, the mainstream press, will say that they need to improve their earnings or they need to have a management change. Nobody in mainstream press is pointing out that this is a pump and dump scam. This is a scandal. This is a joke. All the insiders, Mark Zuckerberg sold out for over $1 billion in stock already, probably closer to $3 billion in stock already. Everyone who has invested, all the VCs, all the people who have been in part of this thing for the last 5-10 years, sold out. They've already sold long ago. They've made their billions long ago. There's no incentive to actually make this company worth anything anymore because the people who put it up originally are already gone. They're gone. It's nothing left. So, it's just a huge, huge scandal. But I think the scandals are so many and so on top of each other, people just lose track.
So Groupon is down 75% since it went public. But with Zynga, there's something unique. Something you said you've never seen, which is 97% owned by retail investors. So explain.
No, it's Facebook.
Oh, Facebook.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So explain what that means.
Means basically that usually institutions, money managers, and mutual funds and endowments, they usually own part of any stock offering, and you'll see they own between 30, 40, 50, 60% of a company is owned by institutions, and the rest is owned by non-institutional investors or retail investors, you know, mom and pops, individuals. So here you have Facebook, which was $104 billion company with no institutional ownership whatsoever. That 97% owned by retail because all of the institutions sold because it's a massive pump and dump scam. Any institution, any institutional money, any mutual fund, anyone with any half a brain in their head sold out of the stock long ago. But the poor idiot retail investor who sees Barack Obama hugging Mark Zuckerberg in the White House thinks that, oh, well, this must be good. Now they're down 50% on their money. When you lose money like this, of course, what's the arithmetic of losing kicks in. Now, if you lose 50% of your money on an investment, how much of the do you need to make on the remaining investment to break even, Stacy?
100%.
That's right. You need to make 100% just to break even. So now it's the arithmetic of losing, because just to make 5% or 10% is hard enough. But if you are already, you start off your investment at a negative 5 or 10% ditch, then to make up to get positive requires a performance that is above and beyond the average performance. So now, just to break even, you have to have an above average performance, and which is just not, you know, typically what the experience is going to be. And, you know, this is why mutual funds generally are a waste of time, because the fees mean that you started off at a 3% loss. You know, Josh Brown of the Reform Broker was talking about some product that they're selling on Wall Street this month with a 12% commission. So you start the whole thing off with a 12% loss. So now to break even, you've got to make returns that are better than Warren Buffett, of course. So this is, unfortunately, now the Zynga people who bought stock on the offering, the chances of them breaking even are, I would say, 1 in 1,000,000. But that was baked into the cake. That was the point of the whole offering. It was to get people to buy stock from insiders who sold out on their way to making billions and billions of dollars. It's technically illegal, of course, but there is no real law in the securities industry.
Yeah, but again, we just talked about these guys allegedly working in the print room at J.P. Morgan Cazenove and UBS being sentenced to 16 years for insider trading, and it was swift and fast. This now, there are lots of lawsuits being filed against Groupon, Facebook, and Zynga.
Right, okay, well, on the lawsuit front, when you open an account to buy stock in these companies, you signed with that new account form into binding arbitration, which means that you don't have the right to take your case before a judge and a jury. You only have the option of taking your case before a panel, an arbitration panel, which is managed by Wall Street. It's stacked with brokers and bankers. And so less than 2% of any case brought before any of these arbitration panels ever results in clients ever getting paid back. I mean, I said last year that when the Teamsters Union discovered that Goldman Sachs had stolen money from their pension account, they eventually resorted to intimidating force, intimidating Goldman Sachs with physical force. And that's how they resolved that issue. But short of being a Teamster, having your money stolen, you go, you know, and I said when I worked on Wall Street, that was a common line from management, is that you don't care what you do because you're going to go to arbitration and nobody ever loses. So unless you're getting sued by at least one customer, you know, you're not doing your job. You're not showing enough initiative.
Plus, presumably you've stolen all their money, so you made it difficult for them to go to court. Now, I want to show you that Zynga, yeah, which is down, it's, I guess in the aftermarket, must be down under $3. But the biggest institutional shareholder was Morgan Stanley, who, of course, took it public. Now, however, they've sold 303 million shares. But if you go over to mutual fund ownership, this is on money.msn.com, you find that the number one mutual fund ownership of Zynga is Morgan Stanley. They own 10 million shares in their international fund mid-cap growth. But that, by the way, that is down 50 million. I don't know who they sold that to, but there's also a big owner is Morgan Stanley Focus Growth Group. And so there are two Morgan Stanley mutual funds in the top 10 owners of on the mutual fund side for Zynga. So those presumably are their pension funds. Their mutual funds are the passive investors got sold a bunch of bad shares.
Well, yeah, that brings up a number of questions, because Morgan Stanley that takes the company public is supposed to do due diligence. They're supposed to, which they didn't do, clearly, because the company was not able to generate any meaningful earnings whatsoever, and the entire model was a joke. So they didn't do the due diligence. So that's the problem with taking the company public to begin with. Second of all, they put shares into these passive funds that they themselves own on a company that they themselves are taking public that they didn't do any due diligence on. That's a huge conflict of interest. And another, those people who've lost money in those funds had that money stolen. I mean, this is another common Wall Street practice, is that these fund managers work with analysts and underwriters for under the counter for bribes, which are carried on the books officially as research. This is another huge Wall Street scam. It's called research. These fund managers will pay Morgan Stanley money Morgan Stanley will pay these companies lots and lots and lots of money, which they carry on their books as a line item called research. It's cash in the bank. The fund company, at the quid pro quo, will accept a lot of this garbage stock that they know it's going to obliterate their accounts. But it's a bribe. You know, one of the probably the worst stories, which we haven't heard about, I'm sure it'll come out soon enough, is when Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch. Because you had Merrill Lynch brokers that are corrupt in selling people these types of products that are incredibly just garbage. They then had access to all of Bank of America's customers as a list. You know, you can't cold call people anymore so much as easily because of these do not call lists. But if you Bank of America and you're Merrill Lynch, Merrill Lynch can call Bank of America customers because that you are their customer officially. So they have millions of accounts with people with $500,000, $2 million, $5 million in their account. Now you get the call from the Merrill Lynch broker who puts you in things like Zynga, Groupon, some fund that owns Zynga, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm pretty certain that within not too distant future, we'll hear about lots and lots and lots of Bank of America customers, Merrill Lynch, who are making public the fact that they all got, and many of them got just wiped clean from this plague of locusts of Merrill Lynch brokers.
Now, actually, I was looking at this, the big owners of Zynga, and one thing you do notice, that you can compare the institutional ownership versus mutual fund ownership. This past week, there's been very little selling by the institutional owners. And the top one is Morgan Stanley, then Capital Research, then Partner Fund Management, Vanguard, New Jersey Division of Investment, Federated Investment. Almost no selling at all. Now, you go over to the mutual fund ownership, and over the past week, there's been massive selling. Morgan Stanley, the mutual fund, got rid of 50 million shares of, I guess they held 60 million by the looks of it. But there's massive selling from like Pacific Select Midcap Growth Portfolio sold 90% of their holdings. Franklin Small to Midcap Growth Fund sold 75% of their holdings. So they were selling while the stock market, while the price was collapsing. What does that suggest to you?
Well, Morgan Stanley, the underwriter, remember this company is still, it's only been public for 6 months or something. There are certain lockup agreements for the underwriter as well. So they're technically prevented from selling over a certain period of time. And, but this is just a cost of doing business. They're willing to go through this as long as there are other ways to work around this to commit the overall fraud. But this is not a huge position for them. Although Morgan Stanley is rumored to be the next major firm to go bankrupt.
Yeah, I did see on Zero Hedge during the overnight 40% drop in the aftermarket of Zynga, Zero Hedge was suggesting that Morgan Stanley was having to sell off big commodity positions and other stuff in order to meet margin calls somewhere on Zynga.
Right. Also, as the underwriter, they control the float, so they could be short Zynga stock somewhere else on their balance sheet that offsets the loss on the long position. So they're making a market in the stock. So they could have a huge short position, so that net they're flat. They don't own any stock really.
And what about, you were a big options trader?
Yeah.
What about Facebook? Remember, wasn't it Facebook that you read that there was something like 4 calls to every put before?
No, that was actually Zynga. There was
oh my gosh.
6 before the stock collapsed 40%. There was, and the options trading people were buying calls, you know, going, they're making a bet of the stock going up 6 times higher than making bets that it would go down. So they were buying a lot of these calls, a lot of these options. So they, of course, got wiped out, 100% gone. They'll never come back. The money went to option heaven, as we say. And so there was a lot of speculative option buying right before the collapse. Yeah, that's right.
Now, once again, this is The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM. I will give you advance warning, by the way, just so you know. I know many of our listeners are very fragile and suffer from withdrawal symptoms in the case of us not being here, but Resonance 104.4 FM will not have new programming for August 20th, August 27th, and September 8th or 9th, I forget what it was, but we will not be on the air for 3 Saturdays in a row, so just so you know, and get ready, stock up on some Sensimillion, and get ready for...
Oh, yeah, there's going to be some serious bath salts and booze. But in September, though, we're going to be living in London, aren't we, Stacey?
That is a truth. And we'll be doing the truth, hopefully. I hope we're not shocking anybody at Resonance right now, but we're going to hopefully be doing this show live. So there'll be some more call-ins and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, my idea is I want to do the show, Truth About Markets, live at Resonance, and then go to the pub and do another hour of stand-up rage. You know, I think I could do that, you know, depending, we could do that once or twice a month. You know, people can come in. I've done that before with Resonance. You know, we've had meetups and stuff. And but my stand-up rage show has evolved. So now, you know, it could be, there's so many scandals and everything. So we just do a whole live get-together right after the show. So we need a venue. Wasn't there a pub right near the Resonance, or do we need a different venue? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, no, that one's a good one because, you know, all the younger sort of folks live over in the side of town. And it's a good venue. Ye Old King's Head, I think it's called.
Well, that is that the one near Residence?
Yeah, with King Henry VIII in the background.
Okay. Yeah, the King's Head was good. Upstairs at King's Head?
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, we could do it. We should charge like £2 just to raise money for Residence, probably, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Now, speaking of King's Heads, we have the monarchy and the aristocracy of the banking class. Now, Tony Blair, geez, this guy's back in the news. He was he won't shut his trap, really. He just keeps on interviewing with all sorts of people. But he was interviewed by The Telegraph, and he said that society would not be better served by hanging 20 bankers at the end of the street. But in light of yesterday, I think that would have been a fantastic opening ceremony for the Olympics. It would have been true old school sort of Olympics, you know, event.
Well, I mean, it was Versailles-like. So, you know, at the height of the Versailles court, when you had the... When the price of food got to a certain point, price of wheat, then the revolution took place. Now, around the world, because of the drought which has now gone global. Droughts in Europe, America, and Asia. Price of wheat and corn are moving up sharply. So price of food in the next 6 months or so could be at that critical Versailles Revolution moment. So, you know, Tony Blair is just basically channeling the future when he might find himself in a very uncomfortable position.
And he also said that the public were wrong to be outraged by the financial crisis. He said they were wrong. And soon after, some men from the so-called print room at Tony Blair's bank, J.P. Morgan, were sentenced to 16 years for allegedly insider trading.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, what about Mervyn King last week? He came out and said that the global financial crisis is the result of policymakers around the world making macroeconomic policy blunders and has very little to do with bank fraud, which is clearly a lie. You know, that's it's not a macroeconomic policy issue. The problem is that on the microeconomic stage of price discovery and supply and demand curves, we have fraud. Like LIBOR is a microeconomic fraud that has corrupted the system to the point where 500 trillion in contracts now are invalidated. But Mervyn King, Bank of England head, makes this, but this is usual, isn't it? Because they blame, ultimately what he's doing, he's blaming Mr. Market again. There's this thing called King Market, Louis XVI, King Market, that runs our lives here in the court of Versailles in the city of London. And he's a divinely inspired king, old King Market. And we can't do anything about it. And the crisis is because of a force majeure from old King Market. Bankers themselves who've been caught red-handed laundering money for drug cartels, rigging rates, trading in inside information, manipulating markets. No, they had nothing to do with it. It's old King Market. And so Mervyn King fraud is just talking out of his bottom. You know, it's really shameless what he's saying there, because it's so far from the truth and so far from reality. But as I said, you know, the price of food is getting at that critical stage, and, you know, King Versailles didn't last forever, did it?
Here's a picture of the Queen from last night. She looks real happy. She must be tired of all these frigging big events. What's going on with Britain lately? They're always throwing all these mass, like, it really is. You know, in America, everybody sinks into this bath salt sort of zombie flesh-eating, you know, mass massacres. In Britain, they've sunk into, I guess, in these apocalyptic times, just like celebrating big giant celebrations, the Queen's Jubilee, the Olympics. You know, what's going on?
Basically a death rattle.
Yeah.
You know, before people die, they get up and do a little dance, then they keel over. This is like the death rattle of the British economy for this century already.
Yes, and I did read that, you know, that death rattle thing is often a difficult thing to prepare. Doctors often have a difficult time with that because the families get a lot of hope suddenly that, oh, look, Dad's all fine now. He's going to live. He's going to be around. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, he's about to drop dead. Sorry.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's the Jubilee and the Olympics are the death rattle, followed by a sharp contraction of GDP and an economic. You know, the UK, by some measures, is now entering a depression.
Depression. Well, that's true, but the bizarre thing about this compared to the Great Depression, I suppose, is that the first Great Depression is just how much, I guess, the cities like New York and London, where the fraud is still enabled and allowed, and the theft. You know, these bankers are getting richer and richer. So it's hard to really see the depression because people still do have access to credit and food stamps and stuff like that. So you don't see so much, you know, in America, there's 50 million now on food stamps. I think there were like 25 million before the crisis, the depression. So that's 25 million people who would otherwise be at the, you know, at the breadline. Now they're, this is the digital sort of breadline.
Well, yeah. Again, using my Versailles analogy, I mean, Versailles was a huge city and town. Everyone living there was convinced that everything was great. All the major, that's all they heard. They were in the bubble of Versailles until the bubble popped. So these cities, in some quarters in New York and London, people are, you know, down there with the billionaire yacht Row in Canary Wharf. Is it Canary Wharf or Cannery Wharf? Canary Wharf.
Canary
Wharf. And so...
But that's funny, actually, that you said that, because, of course, Cannery Row was a Great Depression film as well. So
they, it was in the novel by... who was the novelist who wrote... Grapes of Wrath was written by
Steinbeck.
And so Cannery Row figures heavily in that. But we've gone from Cannery Row to Canary Wharf, and we're going to go back to Cannery Row, because the Versailles bubble, and I think that's the best way to describe it, really, because it's, it puts it into context outside of a normal economic bubble. I mean, you have booms and busts, and you have bubbles occur, and the bubbles, you know, real estate bubble pops, and then, you know, it's picked up by the, it was a dot-com bubble before that, and there was a certain continuum that's related to macroeconomics and finance. But we're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about a Versailles bubble. We're talking about the 1% of the top 1%. Having successfully confiscated many hundreds of trillions. You know, they came out with that report that the there's $30 trillion parked in various accounts by this Versailles class that they're just now coming to grips with. That's $30 trillion. Now, I've said this many times. People, on the, especially on the right, you know, the Atlas Shrugged type, the Lou Rockwell libertarian crowd will say, we of the 1%, we pay most of the taxes. You know, of the $2 trillion of taxes collected last year in America, something like 40% or 60% came from the top 10% of the workers, of the population. But that's only on reported income. You know, look at Mitt Romney, for example. His adjusted rate is below 15%. And he's somebody who's completely above board and legitimate. Whereas most of the 65,000 people around the world with net worths of $100 million or more, their effective tax rate is zero. Look at these corporations like General Electric. Tax rate is zero. But they did file a 17,000-page tax return. So it's true that they pay a big tax chunk compared to people who pay zero taxes, who have incomes less than $9,500 a year and pay zero tax. Yes, if somebody like Mitt Romney has his adjusted rate, pays tax, it looks like he's paying an awful lot of tax. And yet, but when you put in the full picture of $30 trillion that's not reported at all, on a $60 trillion global GDP, and you see the recycling of that money being trapped on banks and not entering the public domain in terms of infrastructure at all. So, you know, Stacey, you know, last week also there was that bit where Barack Obama made a comment about entrepreneurs are really standing on the shoulders of people coming before them. No man is an island. That the great success stories have somebody who came before them or are building on top of an existing infrastructure that is in part contributed by the government. And he made the statement that, well, you didn't build that.
You didn't build the roads, the highways,
yeah, the
railroad.
A company, like he was saying, like, well, you know, Steve Jobs, Apple Computer, you didn't build that, you know, because it's on top of, in part, many things that were built by the community, by society, by government. And so this became a huge, on the right wing, outrage that, you know, and Scott Brown in Massachusetts, who's a politician, had a video of celebrating America and that individualism, et cetera, et cetera. But this obviously is problematic. Did you see that?
I did, and I am looking for this quote from Thomas Paine, who, again, you know, there's a selective reading of everything, the selective reading of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. They just pluck the things out that fit with their ideology and their theft, right? And they don't tell anybody else because they know nobody is going to bother to read the other 700 pages of The Wealth of Nations to see what it really says. Now, you know, that radical right who is now, well, the right wing who is saying, oh, Barack Obama is wrong, and they're the ones constantly banging on about the founding fathers. Well, one of the most important founding fathers is, of course, Thomas Paine. And it was, let me see, he wrote The Age of Reason and The Rights of Man and Common Sense, which was an all-time best-selling American book that advocated colonial America's independence from the Kingdom of Great Britain. And Common Sense was so influential that John Adams said, quote, without the pen of the author of Common Sense, the sword of Washington would have been raised in vain. So, but he said, Andrew Sullivan at the Daily Beast provided a quote from him where he said almost word for word, actually, what Barack Obama did, basically that, you know, you stand on the shoulders of those who came before you, and it takes a community to build a prosperous nation.
Right. You know, Hillary Clinton wrote, it takes a village, etc. But, you know, there's this idea, especially in this libertarian crowd, that that there is no such thing as a society. You know, Margaret Thatcher famously said just that. She said, there is no such thing as society. And, you know, Margaret Thatcher, of course, we were just talking about this on the show. She allowed all those council flats to go privatized and people to buy those council flats and pushed out public housing. And now in America, in Los Angeles, they're doing the reverse. They're taking people's private property. The government's using eminent domain, government/corporations, using eminent domain to push out the private owners and to dump all that private property into the communal pool. So the corporations, of course, they're doing that not because they have some idea about community values, but because they figured out a way to wrap up all those mortgages once again into a securitized bundle, give themselves huge multi-billion dollar fees. But the argument just doesn't hold up. The whole libertarian argument just doesn't hold up. I don't see it. I don't see where anyone's been able to make that argument successfully who's on the front line of the economy. I mean, people like, you know, in the LouRockwell.com, the people who write for that site and that idea, none of those people, as far as I can tell, have a identifiable source of income. They don't really work for a living. They don't do jobs. They just pontificate about an ideology and the Austrian school of economics, but they don't actually, what do they do? What does Lou do for a living except comment about a utopian state of libertarianism that doesn't exist? It's absurd. It's just an absurd conceit. It makes no sense. It's a non-starter. And it just, I don't get it. What does he do? He doesn't do anything.
I found the Thomas Paine quote. separate an individual from society and give him an island or a continent to possess, and he cannot acquire personal property. He cannot be rich. So inseparably are the means connected with the end in all cases that where the former do not exist, the latter cannot be obtained. All accumulation, therefore, of personal property beyond what a man's own hands produce is derived to him by living in society, and he owes on every principle of justice, of gratitude, and of civilization a part of that accumulation back again to society from whence the whole came. Yeah, I mean, I do... I'm very much, like, believe the government should stay out of people's private lives. They should be more like a utility function. It's like they should go back to pre-Glass-Steagall sort of things. They shouldn't be an activist sort of thing. They should provide, you know, the basic functions like the railroad systems, the roads, whatever it is, the healthcare, you know, things that for the lowest cost that everybody has to use, like those functions that are public goods that everybody has to use. There should be, you know, and we see the problem. What do they always say about Africa? You know, all this money is given to them, all this food, all this stuff is donated, but the problem is distribution, because yeah. They have no functioning governments down there. They have no sort of way to, you know, build roads and railroads and stuff like that. The only thing that did was, of course, the British Empire built some railroads that are still being used.
Yeah, the government is the economic choice for things like building roads. Okay, it's a job that requires procurement of many hundreds of tons of concrete and tarmac and minimum wage workers. You know, building roads. It's a commodity business. It's all cost based. You want it to do it the cheapest possible way. You don't want private companies competing building roads, because the cost will go up in an insane way that defeats the purpose of building a road. The same thing with healthcare. Healthcare is a commodity business for 99% of it. You want the government buying the drugs. Get the cheapest price, and to pressure the drug companies to get the cheapest price, because then you have a society. Well, I mean, the social mobility in the States is now horrible. It's much higher. Okay, we got to go, huh?
Well, you got to go. We're at the very end, right, so they're going to have to go cut away to the next show.
All right, well, then, say goodbye, y'all.